Hello and welcome to another episode of Golden Grenades, a podcast about birds with stories from those of us who recognise them as our avian overlords, all set against the heartwarming and cheery backdrop of the end of the world. My special guest on this episode is freelance conservationist and writer Emily Joachim. Emily has been obsessed with wildlife, particularly raptors and owls, since childhood, and after completion of her zoology degree, worked for various conservation organisations such as Avon Wildlife Trust and the Zoological Society of London, before spending 4 years studying the breeding ecology of the little owl for her PhD. She has worked with long-term nest box monitoring groups for over 15 years and founded the UK Little Owl Project in 2015. Emily, welcome to Golden Grenades.
Hi, Kate.
Fantastic to have you on. We've been attempting to get together and coordinate our diaries for a long, long time, but finally we've done it. Here we are. How did your passion for wildlife and especially birds of prey start?
Well, I was really lucky because I spent most of my childhood in Mid Wales, and my parents had this tiny little cottage that wasn't done up. And we all had to cram in, but because it was so small, we were just always out and about in the garden. And I was really lucky. I was near places like Elan Valley and Lake Vyrnwy, so we didn't really have toys. We were just out and about all the time. And I suppose my first big obsession was when I used to go to Elan Valley, and that was the last place you could see red kites at that time, in the 1980s, before the reintroductions. And yeah, I just became obsessed with trying to find red kites. And then I was obsessed with mushrooms. And I remember at school, I used to get in trouble during reading hour because I would memorize all the Latin names of mushrooms. And they told me that wasn't reading. And they took my mushroom book from me and gave me Roald Dahl instead. So
there's not many kids that would be obsessed with mushroom Latin names.
I know, but it's just, I think that's just what it's like when you get into nature, isn't it? You just get these obsessions and then they build and build. And then you realise you could spend your whole life learning about wildlife and really know so little. So,
but you branched out from mushrooms, didn't you? Which I think was possibly a good thing, certainly for the owls of this country.
Well, the obsession with birds of prey were always there. And I mean, it was, you just have those moments where you decide maybe what you want to do when you're younger. And it was, I remember we were driving home from this waterfall in Wales, I think it's Pistol Rider, and there was this tawny owl on this fence post. And I remember my parents just stopped to the car and we just looked at it for, you know, over a minute, and it was just at eye level and just seeing its amazing black eyes. And I think having that opportunity to be in the countryside is also, and just seeing the wildlife is what makes your passion grow as well.
Absolutely. And you've done a host of different conservation jobs over the years, haven't you? And there's challenges to that, I guess.
After my zoology degree, I did a general placement, and during that I had to do learning to fell trees, laying hedges, habitat management, doing land management plans. And I think it's a really good foundation to have. Looking back now though, that some of the measures that we used to do, like we used to only look for 20 wildflower species in a meadow for some of our condition assessments. And now, you know, there's, for example, on Salisbury Plain, there's fields which I can find 30, 40 species. The measure seems so low now in some of the conservation targets. But yeah, it's it was wonderful doing all those different jobs. I mean, they weren't paid, unfortunately, but you had to kind of do them to get that experience and get your first paid job.
We've known each other for several years, although actually we've only met once, but it's our shared love of two things, largely birds, I guess, but also detectorists, that has kept us corresponding. And I was thinking that your nest box monitoring groups could surely provide Mackenzie Crook with material for a new programme.
I mean, yeah, I think what I loved about the detectorist show is it was exactly kind of like how things are in birding groups, the little discussions about things and how things are, and there's always someone in the group who's really pedantic about certain things, and the humor, and it's just, yeah, it's everything about it. I suppose it's the charming side of British culture alongside working with birds, and some of the funniest memories that we have, it's just being all out together and things going wrong and laughing. And yeah, it's brilliant. Like we broke down in the middle of Salisbury Plain, and we drove over this area, every tire we had on our vehicle punctured, and we had to wait to be rescued because you can't get AA on the on Salisbury Plain, so you have to wait for the military to come and rescue you. And it's just all these funny moments. I went up a tree once and I was completely stung with bees and they were all laughing. There was bees there. You just never know what you're going to find. You open up a box, sometimes you find hornets, bees, birds you're not expecting. It's just, I think it is addictive as well, because each year you're waiting to see what you find in the box, how many there are, and what's going on. It's like an exciting adventure. And it's that, yeah, like in The Detectorists, that little group going out together, that shared passion. It's lovely. So that's why I love the show. Yeah.
It's great though, isn't it? And I love the fact as well that your monitoring nest box monitoring groups appeal to all ages.
Yeah, they do. And I mean, the people in our group are the average ages in their 80s now, and there's a couple of members who are in their 90s, and they just carry these really heavy ladders that, I mean, to be honest, I struggle with carrying them, and they've got them pretty much above their heads walking through the fields because they've been doing all this for so many years that they're just so fit. They swing their legs over the stiles, and yeah, it's amazing.
Oh man, that's something to aspire to, isn't it, in your
Yeah,
90s?
definitely.
Amazing. You've been very kind in the past, and I've had a couple of exciting parcels through the post from you. Stinky parcels of owl pellets when my kids were a bit younger. They love nothing more than getting a parcel from you of owl pellets to dissect. I mean, as a kid, surely dissecting an owl pellet is one of the best things you can do.
Well, to be honest, even as an adult, and one of my best jobs was I was working at the Hawke Conservancy, and I was tracking tawny owls for them. But it was such a packed day because I'd start at 8:30 in the morning and I'd finish about 11 at night, and there were all things I was doing throughout the day to do with birds of prey, from feeding eagles and vultures to, and one of my activities at lunchtime was dissecting pellets with the children. And I had this little box, like a DIY toolbox, and I saved all my best finds. And I had a mole skull, bug skulls, bats. It's absolutely incredible what you find in them. So yeah, I kind of, it was amazing with the children. So by the end of the summer, I just had this amazing box of goodies from pellets.
That must have been great. I mean, teaching groups of kids to dissect pellets, because they do just love it, don't they?
They do always think they're poos, though, to begin with, always.
Another aspect of work that you've done over the years is giving advice to landowners about how to manage the land for wildlife. How have you found that work?
Well, I've really enjoyed it, and I think because I've got an unofficial capacity that, I'm just there in my normal clothes, just being friendly and having a chat. I find that showing them birds, even on some of the estates that activities take place there that I personally don't like, shooting. That there's one shooting estate, for example, that they've now got barn owls, kestrels, hobbies. They did have a Montague Harrier flying through, and buzzards. I mean, on estates like that, I find it difficult because I don't agree with these pheasant shoots, but it is overall, I found that landowners have been quite receptive to some of the ideas, and once they see the results, they generally have been really, really supportive.
That's brilliant. Yeah, I think a lot more landowners and farmers are, trying to be more friendly towards wildlife and managing the land in that way.
Yeah, but there's a huge difference, I think, because some of the estates I go to, they might have 20,000 acres, which I can't even imagine they're owning that much land, and 30,000 acres. And sometimes they do just feel like industrial wastelands, and they're in these environmental schemes, and they do the very bare minimum, whereas some other farms that I'll go to, it's amazing. Like, they'll cut the hedges in rotation every 6 years. They're huge. Like, that's how hedges you can imagine should be. You really do see the wildlife there. Even when we're sitting in our vehicle having lunch, you just see all the insects crawling over the screens, and even the butterflies in a good year, you really notice the difference. So I found overall that it's actually been the smaller scale farmers that are doing the most for wildlife.
Yeah, I could imagine that actually. And that probably leads us nicely on. You've just mentioned ecological wasteland there. And the concept of this podcast is that you get to choose five species of birds to save from the environmental Armageddon. And you've chosen five species to talk about today. And one or two might not be a surprise, but I'm sure one or two will. So let's crack on. And we'll talk about your five birds. Tell us about
bird number one. One, one, one.
The bird number one has to be osprey.
So, what is it about ospreys that you love so much?
Well, I mean, being a bird of prey, I of course adore them. I adore birds, but I don't know what it is about birds of prey, but I'm just absolutely It's just something that they do for me when I see them. It's the power and the grace, and I find it so beautiful. But for me, my love of ospreys is also linked to, I'd say, the best experience of my whole life so far. I'd met in 2009 Roy Dennis at this big raptor conference in Scotland, and he was doing one of the field trips, and I went to Speyside, and he told us all about the work he did, and I kind of stayed in contact with him. And in 2016, I had the best phone call of my life because Roy called me up and he asked me, "Am I any good at cutting fish?" I kind of smiled and said, "Why?" And he said, "Because I've got 20 baby ospreys that need looking after, juvenile ospreys, as part of two translocation projects. And I was wondering if you could come up and be responsible for feeding them for the week." I mean, it was just one of those jobs that you think, is this real? And I just couldn't sleep before going up there. I was so excited, and it was the best experience ever. I mean, can you imagine looking after 20 baby ospreys?
That's mad. Getting a call from the legendary figure Roy Dennis, anyway, who's been so instrumental in conservation for decades now, and specifically reintroduction schemes and bringing species back from the brink. I mean, he's brilliant. So getting that phone call anyway, and then saying, "Oh, and you're looking after 20 baby ospreys that we're going to move down to the south of England."
Well,
Unbelievable.
some of them went to the Basque Country, so eight of them were going to the Basque Country for the final year of that translocation. And one of my most surreal experiences, it was first thing in the morning, and the eight ospreys were going on a flight, and I had to feed them at the airport before their flight. And I remember seeing all the helicopters going off in Aberdeen to the oil rigs, and I was there, with ospreys between my legs, giving them a feed. It was so surreal. And then I went back on the train to Roy's, and then I had to get the other 12 ready for their journey down to Poole Harbour. So it was, I didn't really sleep for 48 hours. There was so much to do, but it was amazing.
And how did you get them down to Poole Harbour?
Well, Tim drove them down, Tim McCrill, who obviously is leading the reintroductions in England. So he does the work in England with the assistance of Roy, but Tim leads that. It must have been quite early in the morning, and we were driving down, but the excitement is just, you can't put it into words. It was, when you're so excited that your whole body's buzzing, it was like that the whole way. And then I remember when we arrived with them, and Paul Morton was waiting there, and all the team from Birds of Poole Harbour. And I remember that Paul gave me a hug, and we were both absolutely trembling and shaking because it was just that excitement that this was the start of them being reintroduced into southern England, where they haven't bred for, so hundreds of years now. So it was the most exciting day. And to have that opportunity to be involved in a project like that, I mean, I'll never forget it.
If you're listening to this, folks, Emily just said that she and Tim McCrill drove a car with eight baby ospreys in the boot.
No, we drove a car with 12. Yeah, 12. And to say that they were driven, they had the most luxury traveling conditions. So they had all beautiful moss in their boxes, and we stopped and we fed them en route, and then they had a little rest. They were more precious than gold, the way they were being treated. It was very precious cargo.
I love the fact that you like stop to feed them and let them have a little rest, like you're just pulling them to a service station. Like okay, kids, 5 minutes, toilet break.
And yeah, I remember chopping up the fish before we went, and we had all cool boxes to keep all their food really fresh. And yeah, because they were fed trout from somewhere near Cairngorm Mountain, and yeah, everything was hand prepared and fresh for them. They had the best of everything. And but do you remember when I was telling you that what really shocked me is how the young quack like ducks? We all know kind of the sound of ospreys, don't we? And it's just not a sound that you hear. They'd sound a bit like a quacking duck. So I remember I made a voice recording of the sound, and you couldn't believe it,
Yeah,
could
I
you?
do. I remember getting some incredible photos from you around about that time in DM messages in Twitter. It was always brilliant opening like photos, and it was just half a dozen ospreys staring up in a box.
Roy and Tim would go out, and they'd monitor the nests, and usually the ones that were translocated, it would be, say, a nest with three, and raising three osprey chicks is quite a lot for the parents. So it would usually be, say, the smallest chick, so it increased the chances of survival of the two remaining ones, and then also the one that was being translocated. So Roy and Tim would go out, and they'd monitor nests over quite a large area. Sometimes they'd travel over 100 miles in a day, checking different sites, and then they'd come back quite late at night, and then Roy would pass me the osprey. They do like a health, just a check on them, ring them, And then for the first day or two, they'd be really, really checked over to make sure that they're eating properly. And they had their fish would be, we'd chop it to the right size for them. So I remember being in the area where the ospreys were in the middle of the night chopping fish to make sure there was enough. Because when they were 20, it was unbelievable how much fish that they all got through.
I bet you smelt lovely at that time.
Yeah, I was absolutely covered in midgy bites as well. I was surprised how gentle young osprey chicks are compared to feisty kestrels about to fledge. Obviously, they weren't about to fledge at that point, the ospreys, but the kestrels can have so much attitude. But the ospreys just kind of sink down and hunker down and lie there because that's their defense strategy, isn't it? But they're just so beautiful. Like, you could just stare at them all day long. They're just amazing birds.
I'm going to dive right in and get my zero punches pulled question out early doors here.
Zero punches pulled.
So this is a question that hopefully you've never been asked before and maybe you're unlikely to ever get asked again. But my question to you is, if you could have a cardboard box full of any species of baby bird in the boot of your car, excluding ospreys, which would it be?
Has to be baby swifts.
Oh, baby
It's
swifts.
their wings. In my mind, they're always on their wing. I just can't imagine what it would be like to see the young. And you know, some people who rescue them and they have these little knitted nests with all these wings hanging out. I mean, I've never seen anything like it. And I think, yeah, I would love to see baby swifts.
I'm always really jealous when people have got a grounded swift in their hands and they've got that photo where they, like you say, the wings just look ridiculous.
It's really exciting because on Salisbury Plain, we've got one of those swift towers up, you know, with loads of boxes. And I've been playing the call for about 4 years. And swifts moved in last year. And now there's so many swifts they're expecting this year that, yeah, we're finding someone to ring the swifts this year. So that's going to be really exciting.
Oh, do you think you'll get the call?
I'm going to try. Yeah, go there. I think I'll tag along anyways.
Brilliant. Well, I might not give up on my Swift boxes. I think this is year three
Do you play a
now.
call?
I did the first couple of years. I couldn't last year because my son was doing exams at the time. I'd quite like a cardboard box full of emperor penguin babies. They look. Yeah, I think emperor penguin babies are indistinguishable from their cuddly toy version. They're crazy. Oh, I tell you what would be quite good as well. Baby ostriches, they're cute, but you know fine well they're going to turn into dinosaurs. So that would be quite cool as well.
Is I mean, even people say that squabs, baby pigeons, and stock doves aren't cute, but I still find them really sweet. I just don't like the smell much. It's got a funny smell.
You don't see many baby, or I don't see many baby pigeons, and I've definitely not been close enough to smell one. I know that you're an aficionado of sticking your nose into plumage, though.
Oh, but it's the best. Like, I think one of the joys about bird ringing is obviously it's all about the science and the birds and what we learn about, but something that isn't perhaps spoken about as much is the sheer joy and privilege of being that close to birds. I mean, I find it an absolute honor to have that opportunity and to be able to smell them, and you become a bit like a detective of their nest. So I've now got the skills that I can open up a nest box and work out whether they've fledged or not, or if it's been used that year or last year. There's just all these little signs that you pick up, and yeah, you become a detective of birds.
That's brilliant. What's the best smelling bird?
Of the birds that I've worked with, I did really like the osprey because I went out with Roy to one of the sites in the forest, and one of the juveniles had in its talon a little bit of osprey nest, which obviously I proudly keep now as one of my best ever possessions. It's just a tiny bit, and it's just such a lovely smell of like kind of a mossy, herby smell. I like the smell of tawny owls as well. When it's really hot in summer, like, and you have a box of say six or seven barn owls are in there, and they're quite big, and it's really hot, and I climb up to the top of the barn, and you open up the box, it's just the strongest smell of pure ammonia. And
Oh.
that's quite, and then you have to, when you do have nest boxes, you have a responsibility to maintain them. So every year or every 2 year, you know, all the pellets that the barn owls cough up, they build up in the bottom of the box and it can get inches thick. So you have to scoop it out and it becomes this solid mass of ammonia smelling disgustingness. and you have to get it out, and that can be quite whiffy. But the whiffiest of them all is actually the little owl.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's really whiffy. It's a very, if you get little owl poo on you the whole day, no one wants to be near you. It's really stinky.
Blimey. Bang for your buck with little owl poo there.
Yeah.
One thing I will mention about ospreys, though, is they were extinct, as you suggested earlier. They were extinct for long, long periods from about 1916 right up until 1959, where the pair first bred in Lochgarten in Scotland. And the RSPB, that was the very first, and I didn't realise this until I read it recently, the very first public nest watch point ever. You know, now they're quite commonplace, aren't they? You go to lots of reserves, or there's peregrine watch points in cities even. But that was the very first one in 1959 at Lochgarten.
Yeah, and of course, Roy Dennis was involved with that. And I remember when he took us for a tour at Lochgarten, he was just telling us about how repeatedly that the tree and the nest were being vandalised. Because remember, that was at a time when people were just desperate to have osprey eggs or any eggs, weren't they? It was the egg collecting phase. And so, yeah, there was this idea that if it was really watched and there was a kind of a public passion to watch this nest, that it would naturally be protected.
Fantastic. Well, we must move on to talk about your second bird.
Bird number two.
Yeah, which is the tawny owl. You know when little children are like, oh, I want to do this as my job, and the parents roll their eyes like, that's no way a job. I remember when I saw that owl and I was saying, yeah, I want to work with owls. I mean, my parents didn't think, and it was just, I mean, I made it happen, so I'm really proud that I did. But yeah, it was looking that owl in the eyes. They're just the most amazing birds.
Owls generally are very, very popular birds now, not always in folklore and days gone past, as we'll possibly touch upon.
Yeah, I mean, children are kind of brought up with knowing about the owl and the pussycat. And yeah, owls are that amazing species to get people interested in nocturnal wildlife. But sadly, tawny owl is now an amber-listed bird, which is so sad. At the moment, I'm staying with a friend and there's two local parks nearby and there's no tawny owls. And that really shocks me because my local park, there's three pairs. And I think that every park of a reasonable size should have tawny owls.
I know, and it's another one of those birds that, like many of the birds that we talk about, just because of many birds generally are becoming less numerous, and birds that we were once very familiar with and saw or heard often are becoming less noticeable. I'm lucky I do have tawnies nearby. Oh, and I also had my first ever garden barn owl.
No, you didn't. A garden
I
barn
did.
Owl? How did that happen?
I was letting the dog out and I heard the screech. It wasn't in the garden and I couldn't see it,
yeah,
but I could
still
hear
counts,
it.
So it doesn't
it? It does for me. But yeah, tawny owls, like owls generally, and we've touched upon this in the podcast, they weren't thought of as nice birds in the past. They were omens of bad luck, bringing evil and disaster and misfortune and death. Thankfully, people think of them more favourably, generally.
They do, but it's quite difficult to monitor them because they are nocturnal, obviously. And a big problem that I'm seeing, and again, in these local parks, I find it horrifying, is people apparently feel safer when there's really bright LED lights in park spaces. Personally, I don't. And the research that I've done, it doesn't necessarily reduce crime. So we need to be more mindful about putting this bright light in areas. And a few years ago, the tawny owl was part of Project Owl with the BTO. Part of their research showed that the higher the light pollution, the less likely you are to find tawny owls, which makes sense. But it's a real shame with the increasing lighting of parks and spaces. And that's here, you know, seeing these two parks, just to not hear owls, I'm just so shocked. And my ears are like, now I should be hearing them a lot. So I feel off balance that I'm not hearing owls.
Yeah, it's interesting you're saying about the lights. And I think even in places where the light density, the number of lights hasn't increased, the actual bulbs that are being used, they switched the bulbs around us, they changed the lampposts. And I just had to put my moth trap in the bin, basically,
yeah.
Because, you know, the light now is just so white and so bright that, you know, nothing's going to come to my trap. And yeah, I possibly do hear less owls in the garden than previously. And I wonder if it's to do with that.
It's affecting the whole ecosystem. So I can't believe that a third of insects that encounter light will die. When I was in Budapest, I couldn't believe it. I was looking above the Houses of Parliament where they had lights until 1 a.m. and it was hundreds and hundreds of birds just trapped in this light circling, and they will fly until they collapse and die. And it's just catastrophic for insects. And it is being light pollution has been identified as one of the overlooked drivers of ecological decline. It's horrific, and the insect apocalypse, this massive loss of insects that I know you and I will have witnessed in our lifetime.
Yeah, people talk about it doing noticeably different. You can go on car journeys and there's nothing on your windscreen.
Even things that I was talking to my friend the other day, that I remember as a little girl when I was walking down the streets, that you'd have to dodge the snails. Well, I always used to pick them up and move them to safety. But so going to school, my parents used to roll their eyes. But yeah, there were snails everywhere when it rained. But I just don't see them now because everyone is using snail killers, slug killers, and it's just the impact on everything. Just putting that down, a reduction in hedgehogs and song thrushes. It's so sad.
No, it's true. Let's bring it back to a bit of optimism, which is often difficult in conservation. But you've worked with lots of different species of owls, and there was a particular eagle owl called Duffy.
This was another one of my jobs where I had to pinch myself. When you think, can I call this a job? Because you're having the best days of your life and it feels wrong to say you're at work. Yeah, it was for the Hawke Conservancy Trust. So, when people bring in the young juvenile tawny owls that they see that are branched and they might be on the ground and they think that they're unsafe. So they pick them up and they bring them to a centre to be looked after. When actually, what they should do is either leave it there if there's a decent amount of vegetation, or pop it up slightly higher in the tree just so that it's off the ground from ground predators. So that year, the Hawke Conservancy had 14 owls. They wanted to do this study, so often tawny owls would be soft released back into the wild. So we just wanted to see for the first month or two if the tawny owl survived. So my job was tracking tawny owls in these four woodlands, but I got to live on site with two other workers at the time. We had this little flat. And it was the most amazing experience because we had at night time pygmy owls, Ural owls, Scops owls, milky eagle owls, all hooting away, and we got to walk around amongst them. It was amazing. But next to my bedroom was this eagle owl called Duffy, who was in his 20s, and had arthritis. You don't normally, again, in the wild, a bird with severe arthritis wouldn't survive. So it's quite interesting seeing birds when they're that much older. And yeah, it was such a sweet, sweet. I mean, they've got a cafe called Duffy now after it, and it used to come and bring you rats and put them down, and it would hoot away, and it was so friendly. It was as friendly as like a pet cat or dog to everyone.
Has anybody else ever given you a dead rat as a gift?
No. It was so sweet. But I mean, it was such an experience to have the window open and obviously being in England and hearing all these birds that you just wouldn't normally hear.
Amazing. Right, let's crack on and we'll talk about
Bird number three, three, three.
which I'm surprised has taken us this long to get to be honest.
I know. I thought I couldn't put it at number one because it would be too obvious, but it's obviously the little owl.
Well, your passion for little owls began in 2006 or thereabouts, is that right?
Yeah, so there was a local ringer who actually I still work with now, and he's 87 this year and he's still going strong. And he said, "Would you like to come out and monitor little owls?" And I was like, "Yes, please." And at that point, I didn't actually have my training ringing license. You kind of work your way up to a license. So you start off carrying the equipment and then helping to weigh. You're doing all these jobs and working your way up to holding birds, and then you start your ringing training. And I came out with him, and I remember the one of the adults flew from this oak tree in the middle of the field to the hedgerow, and it did its lovely undulating woodpecker style flight. And then when I saw the little owls, I mean, they really are. I mean, you've seen them, haven't you? They really are small.
Yeah, they're tiny and they're cute whilst being simultaneously furious. And I'm trying to think now, when I was young, I had a kit. It was like cardboard, and it was like a kit, and you made it up, and it was a little owl flying, and I had that hung in my bedroom for years,
Did
proudly displayed. So yeah, it was a bird that I loved long before I saw one. But I do chance upon them occasionally round me.
Their main stronghold is at the moment northeast England and eastern England, and they've very sadly they've rapidly declined. Since 1967, they've declined 78%, but in the last 25, 30 years, they've declined over 60%. But the saddest thing is because they're classified as an introduced, although some people say reintroduced species, they're not on, the Birds of Conservation Concern list where birds are either green listed, amber listed, or red listed. They're just not listed the same as the pheasant. I see the little owls very different from the pheasant in the UK. And if they were listed, they'd be red listed. And because they're not listed, it means that funding is pretty much non-existent for them. And it's really interesting because magazines produced by, let's say, the BTO and the RSPB and other organisations, I often see little owls on them because they're so engaging as birds, and the public love them. But when it comes to projects, they're monitored as part of schemes like Breeding Bird Survey if someone sees a little owl. But there's so few dedicated little owl projects. It's pretty much all by volunteers.
Yeah, which makes you setting up the UK Little Owl Project all the more important, really. And I think, you know, the analogy with pheasants, surely nobody would argue that they're the same as pheasants, because I mean, the pheasants are reintroduced every year, like thousands and thousands and thousands of them. Whereas little owls, whether they were truly a species that lived here in years gone by, but they were introduced through releases in the early 20th century, I believe. Is that right?
It is in the late 19th century they were successfully reintroduced. So there were attempts for it. But it's really interesting because when you dig in the old records, even long before the reintroductions, there was a little owl spotted in Derby. And these were by respectable ornithologists. They weren't, every year I do get a few emails from people saying, and it's they are really sweet. I love all the emails that I get. They'll say, "Oh, I think I found the little owl," and it will be a tawny owl. So obviously there is that chance that some of the prehistorical records could be that. But these were ornithologists who they knew what a little owl was, and they had spotted them, and these were records beforehand. But there was discussions that could they be escapees from bird collections, because people used to have bird collections, didn't they, a lot more than now? Or could it be that they were vagrant birds, or birds that had just somehow made their way across the channel? I mean, some of the little owl ringing recoveries are over 100 kilometres. And you think about the distance between France, where there are little owls, and here, it could be possible that some have come across, but we just don't know.
Yeah, it's not ridiculous to think that.
No.
Unlike the tawny owl, which we know doesn't fly over water, and that's why non-existent island, if you choose to believe that myth or not. But yeah, I mean, I guess maybe they've got a checkered history because they were introduced and then fell foul of the game breeders at the time.
Yeah, that was a massive problem. So in the early, 1900s, when they started to spread, so they spread quite quickly. In about 30 years, they were found in most counties in England and Wales. And then they were accused of killing poults, pheasant poults, and red-legged partridge. And so the BTO commissioned this amazing study with Alice Hibbert-Ware, who analysed what little owls eat. And it was such a thorough study. It looked at their stomach contents, pellet contents, nest contents. Was taken very seriously because of this idea that there was this owl that was, but they were seen as a terror of the game bird industry. And actually, I have come across two gamekeepers that still see little owls as having that reputation. So I guess that's probably been passed on. Their parents were gamekeepers, and maybe it's all been passed on generationally. But I think remains were only found in a couple of instances, and they were remains of game bird poults that had actually died already. So they were almost scavenged.
I think in that study as well, didn't she find 343 earwigs inside one pellet?
Yeah, exactly. And it was a really good study looking back now to actually see what they were eating compared to now. So, I mean, it was loads of dung beetles, daddy long legs, moths, the things that we find now. But she did it to such an amazing level, down to species or genus in most cases. So, and then there was nothing for years. And then it was, there were no studies for about 30, 40 years afterwards. So it's such an understudied species in the UK.
It's a shame that they've got that, or certainly among some people, that they still have that reputation when it clearly isn't and has been proven like almost 100 years ago as not being the case.
Yeah, and I think another problem is that because so sadly so many birds are declining in the UK, it's difficult for conservation organisations to say we're going to give this money. So there was a, I'm not sure whether I could say their name, so I won't say them, but it was a big conservation organisation that does amazing, amazing work for dormice, other British species, and they got in contact with me because they had an orchards project, and they thought it would be great because little owls are obviously strongly associated with orchards, particularly in the past. To link little owls with them. So they wanted me to run a big project for them, but there was no funding available. And it's they could provide funding for the orchard side of it, but not the little owl side.
Yeah.
Even though the little owls they thought would engage people to do conservation work in their orchards. So it's in a bit of a grey area in terms of funding.
Yeah, such a shame because they are, you know, obviously in other countries, particularly around the Mediterranean, they are iconic. Ancient Greece, they were revered, you know, the Greek goddess Athena. you should be telling this, but I will do it because you will know all this already. But the Greek goddess Athena and the Roman goddess Minerva, obviously, became sort of synonymous with the little owl and Athena, who was the patron deity of wisdom, warfare, and handicrafts, which is quite the mix.
But with the goddess Minerva, a few years ago in Bath, it was amazing because I got an email. You know those big sculptures that you have all around Bath, that are all around cities that are painted by different artists. Do you know what I mean? Where they have sculptures all around. Have you seen that?
Yeah, it'll be one particular thing, like a cow, and then local artists all decorate a cow and then put them up around the city or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, so they got in contact with me and they said they wanted to have a little owl. And I was like, wow, because of living in Bath and the link with Roman goddess Minerva. And so that was amazing because I got to help give input in what the statue would look like and a sculpture would look like. And originally they wanted it to look a bit more cartoony owl. And so I insisted it had to look like a little owl.
Brilliant.
And it was just walking around and just seeing... I think it was over 100 little owls all around Bath painted in different ways. That was pretty amazing with that link with the Minerva goddess. And it was through that we did lots of conservation works, talks, getting people to make nest boxes. So that was brilliant.
Brilliant project. I remember that at the time. And this is where owls being wise comes from, isn't it? You know, Athena was wise and knowledgeable when it came to her handicrafts and her warmongering. And because of her association with owls, that's why they're believed to be wise. You know, it's always like wise old owl in tales and then stories, isn't it? But it all comes from that. It wasn't the owl that was particularly wise at all. It was Athena, apparently, because she was pretty good at warring.
Well, it's amazing when you work with owls. I mean, you know how everyone really loves barn owls, and there's no doubt they are beautiful, but out of the species that I monitor, this might be really bad to say, but they're not my favourite personality. So you can't beat a really feisty, tawny owl with really chunky legs and full of attitude. Whereas the barn owl, I suppose it's probably the time at which I monitor them if it's hot and in the daytime and they're well fed. It's the young are just kind of flopped over and lying down. I love the personality of tawny owls and little owls. They're my favourite. But in terms of intelligence, I don't know whether I should say this, but the barn owl doesn't seem the brightest of the owls. So it just doesn't make sense to me. You know, in a year when there's loads of rain, and I mean, it can be really sad. One of the sides of monitoring owls is you can have years that are really painful. So I think it was 2013. There was a period of about 6 days of day and night rain in June. And we were having a really good 20 owl year. And we must have had over 200 young in our boxes. And by the end of the year, we only ringed 12 barn owls because of when it's raining, the barn owls obviously aren't waterproof like the other owls. And they also won't switch to food. So if there's a year when there's quite low field vole numbers, then although they do eat shrews and wood mice as well, they're not as good at diversifying their prey as tawny owls. I've been to tawny owl nests some years and filled with huge rats. They're amazing predators, and that's why I always encourage farmers and landowners, like I say, please don't use any killers for your mice and rats. Just support the land and encourage your owls, and the owls will, when they've got young, they'll take all your rats. And they do.
So you heard it here first, folks, barn owls are a bit thick.
What I am really worried about though with little owls is, so I go to these international little owl symposium which are amazing, and they make me a bit sad as well because there's people there that they're full-time paid little owl workers, but obviously we don't have that structure in the UK. But I kind of go along to represent the UK, but I learn a lot through their countries about what's going on with their little owls and what could be happening. So for example, in the Netherlands, it was low juvenile survival rate, and they found that lots of little owls, I think it was 40% of them, were drowning in water troughs. So they've got this device to now, so that little owls can get out. It's a bit like a ladder rather than something floating. But when you've got a species like the little owl, which will pretty much eat anything going, because they can take small birds. I've been in boxes where there's been lots of house sparrows, but I've been in boxes where there could be rats, small rabbits, they'll take anything. So when you have a species like that declining, it is a huge concern. And no one really knows why. It could be intensive agriculture, but we really do need to focus because the little owl's kind of an indicator of the health of the environment as well.
Yeah, so much more important than people maybe believe, and more than just an introduced species.
Yeah.
Right, Let's move on. Tell us about
bird number four.
It's Pied Wagtail.
Peggy Dishwasher.
Yeah. I mean, I know you can see them all the time, but for me, they're just a bird that I always see and hear more in winter. And it's just in Bath, there's this tree where every year I go, and I go so many times just to see them coming into roost in the winter. And it's just wonderful, isn't it?
I don't have any big winter roosts near me, but I've certainly seen them on the telly. And they do that, don't they? I guess nobody really knows, but the theory is bit of warmth, bit of shelter and safety, but
it's
also
a company as well, apparently. So they're company quite social, and yeah,
information sharing and gathering.
Yeah, and it's just a sound that they make. So they make quite a lot of noise on the nearby roofs, and then they dip down. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, fantastic. And they do make a very identifiable call. I think one of those calls that maybe people can learn quite quickly when they're first developing an interest in birds.
And again, it's one of those species that you can see in the city. But when I was younger, and this is again the whole decline of birds, I remember walking through the city and at dusk I'd always hear loads of sparrows. And I'd see the starlings in murmurations above Bath, and I haven't seen that for over 20 years now. And I'd always hear little wagtails on the buildings. I love that sound.
Yeah, I guess, as you've mentioned, light pollution, declining insect numbers for lots of different reasons, and that's what they feed on. I mean, I mentioned there that, you know, one of their old vernacular names is Peggy Dishwasher and Nanny Washtail. And I think that's because in days gone by, when women would be washing clothes and pots down at the stream or at the village well or pump, they would create a lot of spillages and mud, and then that would attract the wagtails. That's one theory. Or it's just the rhythmic bobbing of the tail, you know, is synonymous with the sort of rhythmic nature of washing clothes and things like that.
I always see them in car parks as well, and they have diversified to eating picnic scraps in car parks. So I love it that even if you stop at a bleak service station by a motorway, there's always one or two wagtails bobbing around, aren't there? They're beautiful.
Yeah, well, they've given up getting the insects off car windscreens now and radiators, and they're probably going for picnic scraps.
It's amazing where the wagtail roost is, because it's in Bath. The lower part of Bath was developed in 2008, and they put this couple of trees there in the centre, and they hang fairy lights in there. And every single year, it's so sweet. People look up and they think, oh, look at these decorations, they're amazing. And then they'll see, you know, how sometimes one or two of them will move around and take a little flight within the tree, and then they'll realise that they're real. It's one of my favourite things about Christmas. They always do it right near Christmas.
You don't see many pied wagtail Christmas decorations. I've got all sorts of very, very random Christmas decorations.
I've seen some of yours online.
Yeah, I post them now and again, generally at Christmas time. Pied wagtail Christmas decorations, there's a gap in the market there, I think.
I found in a supermarket a few years ago these tiny little birds, and they do look a little bit like wagtails. And this year I don't normally have a Christmas tree, but I did have one this year, and yeah, I made it look like a pied wagtail roost. I just filled the whole tree with little birds.
Did you?
Yeah.
That's brilliant. Yeah, you could start a whole industry. Get yourself on Etsy selling pied wagtails for Christmas.
Well, apparently they can't see at night time. I don't know how true that is, but when I was younger, I was walking home after a late night waitress shift, and I found this tiny little pied wagtail on the floor, and it looked completely healthy to me, but it couldn't, the tree was too high for me to get up to, and I didn't have a ladder with me in those days. And so I just took it home for the night. I put on a Christmas stocking in a cat box, and then I walked to work first thing in the morning and let it go, and it flew back up into the tree with its friends. So I just always loved them.
You had a pet pied wagtail for one evening.
Yeah.
That's awesome. We're going to have to move on. Let's talk about your fifth and final choice.
Bird number five.
It's a jackdaw.
Kraken birds.
They are. I mean, they're so beautiful, and they really are not that big in size, but that beautiful shimmery silver and eyes. And I mean, I love them because they remind me of winter, but also because I've been so lucky to monitor them in my nest boxes. But even now, like, I'm just savouring the last sounds of wintering jackdaws, because they're obviously all nest building now. And occasionally they're still making that sound. I just adore them.
Yeah, they're great. I bet you monitoring their nests has been eye-opening.
Well, the people that I work with, they're so fixated on having owls that perhaps they don't jump up and down with the same joy that I do when I see jackdaws. I mean, I saw jackdaws that had just hatched, and they were the sweetest things I've ever seen. They were these tiny little pink completely featherless, ride around. Just that innocence and vulnerability of baby birds always astounds me, you know, when their eyes aren't open. And jackdaws are the most amazing parents. They're really attentive and caring. And what's so beautiful is when you go, there's no jackdaw nests are ever the same. So in some boxes, they'll be filled with really quite big rocks and all sorts. And I've seen spectacles in there, shiny sweet wrappers, bits of coloured string. The amount of dirt that they can take up. Have you ever seen in a jackdaw nest?
I've never actually seen in one, though. They tend to be in chimneys up around here and they're hard to get to.
Do they? But it's amazing how much they can take up, and they can fill a box with sticks. And when I have to empty the sticks at the end of the season, so the box is potentially available for an owl again, it really can be quite hard work. They absolutely ram them in, and there will be hundreds and hundreds of sticks. And the person at the bottom of the ladder always has to hold their breath. And we usually, well, I usually go home with jackdaw hair. I smell of jackdaws, and I've got sticks and things. But it's I had one barn owl box, and it was my favourite. So the barn owls are breeding in there, and then there were jackdaws nesting like in a little under chamber underneath the box entrance, because the owl entrance is higher, and there's a little corridor beneath so that when the young are fledged, they can tuck in under there and they'll be okay. And the jackdaws were nesting there, and then there were jackdaws nesting on the front platform again. The owls can go on there and before they fledge. And then between the box and the barn, a jackdaw had actually taken straw and woven. I didn't even know they could do with this, but it was the most beautifully woven platform just to create a platform to then lay their eggs on. It was stunning.
It was actually woven.
It was woven like the best weaving that you can ever imagine of straw, and it was completely solid to the point that they raised the young on it. Unbelievable. And it was just the fact that this one box provided a site for four birds to nest, and then after they all fledged, stock doves moved in for the winter. So just a box that year was provided. Well, there were actually two barn owl broods as well. So there were six nesting attempts in one box or
That's
on one.
amazing. That truly illustrates how important nest boxes and nest box schemes are.
Yeah, definitely. I really want to go to a place called Buckenham Marshes, where apparently there's 50,000 jackdaws that come in to roost each night.
Fantastic. I think my local jackdaws are possibly not quite as good at the handicrafts as yours. One of my neighbours, I mentioned this when we talked about jackdaws with Stephen Moss on the podcast. One of my neighbours had to have a chimney cleared when he was getting a new stove fitted, and in amongst a jackdaw nest there was a pair of underpants. So, ours don't weave. They just chuck a pair of pants in there.
Maybe that's like, yeah, what they do in your local area. But it's, yeah, mine they had the arts and crafts of jackdaws. So but it's also just seen like they lay their eggs. So even when they bring all the sticks in, they make these beautiful moss cups to make it all soft and lovely for the young jackdaw. I just love them. And when you see the young as well, the beautiful blue eyes.
Yeah, the eyes are stunning, definitely.
I try and make everyone love jackdaws because I feel so sad about the reputation that they have, and I'm not sure why that they do, because I just think they're amazing. And it made me really sad because I went to one farm, and there were shot jackdaws on a, you know, just a horrible pit. They just chucked them and discarded them. It makes me so angry when that happens. And I asked her why she shot the jackdaws, and she said, because you just have to. But she didn't really have a reason why she did it other than that she felt she had to.
That's so strange, isn't it? Yeah, again, something possibly just passed down through generations. Changing those attitudes is often difficult. And I think you mentioned to me that there's a bit of a difference between jackdaws in Britain to European jackdaws.
Yeah, so ours are fairly sedentary, so they're here all year round, stay pretty local. But the European jackdaws are much more migratory in nature. So, for example, they move all around Europe, and some of the jackdaws in from southern Scandinavia actually overwinter here.
So there's definitely more to the jackdaw than people might think. I see them bullying the smaller birds off my bird feeders, and I have to sometimes give the window a little bang so that my siskins can come back. But yeah, they are great birds and they like an underpant.
Mine like spectacles, though. They were red spectacles as well.
You've got highbrow jackdaws, spectacles and
Yeah,
weaving.
they were fancy ones as well. They were designers, so I don't know where they got them from, whether someone dropped them or whether they actually pinched them from someone's garden. I don't know.
That's brilliant. And there's mine in the Y front. Yeah. Anyway, on that note, I'm going to have to bring us back down to earth. We've got to the end. So, as you know, this podcast is based on the increasingly likely scenario of an environmental collapse or Armageddon. and you've chosen these five species to save above all others. But here's the rub. You have to just pick one now, the one bird that will be your demon, your spirit guide as you wander the ecological wasteland. I think I know what it's going
to
be.
It has to be the little owl. It has to be. I mean, my whole life is them, and if I abandoned them now, then it would just be wrong. So it has to be the little owl.
Absolutely. If you'd said pied wagtail, I would have made you choose again. So before we go, Emily, what are the plans for the UK Little Owl Project this year?
Well, I'm going to be updating my website. So people always report their sightings to me, which is great. So I've got this resource of amazing people that I've got in contact with. I mean, some people have little owls in their garden. Can you even imagine that? Like, when I go around to their houses, I just think, how do you do anything if you've got owls in your garden? And so this year I'm going to be updating my website, and I'm going to be collating everyone together. So a bit like kind of what the Barn Owl Trust does, that they have a State of the Barn Owl report, I'm going to do something similar with the little owl. And just, there's so many individuals and groups who are monitoring them alongside barn owls. Maybe they didn't start doing them, but a little owl moves in and then you start monitoring. I'm just collating a resource of what people are doing. And I'm supervised master's student, so I'll probably supervise another master's student too, and just kind of spreading the word of little owls. And I support little owls through things. I get lots of messages from developers who say, we've got little owls, well, what do we do? So just carrying on doing what I can to just give the best advice to landowners, people who love little owls, and just keep lobbying for conservation organisations to do more for them as well.
Brilliant. Really important work too. So people listening might wonder what they can do to help little owls. Would we signpost them to your website?
Yeah, I mean, that would be really good to signpost the website, and also for bird groups to get in contact with me who monitor little owls. And, you know, if anyone wants to, for example, if they've got the right habitat and they know little owls are nearby, I can help provide them with a nice plan for a nest box to make themselves, or someone who I know makes really good nest boxes, and the money that they get for it goes towards their local owl conservation. So I can show them that, or just provide advice, just basically anything little owl related. People can contact me and I'm happy to help.
Brilliant. So you can find Emily and the UK Little Owl Project online just by searching UK Little Owl Project. Emily, thank you so much. It's been a long time that we've been planning to meet together and record this podcast, but you didn't let me down. This was brilliant.
Well, thank you, Kit.